The primary.
Saturday night in Los Angeles, 10 o'clock, and that means, of course, it's open mind. And I am Bill Jenkins. Welcome aboard. For the next 2 hours, we're going to take you on another one of those little journeys. A journey that may sort of stretch your imagination, or we call it your reality box, as it were. You know, we all have one, a reality box. It's the name we put on it, and it seems to have caught on. It works a little bit. If it is something, your reality box is shaped by your education, your living experiences, your thinking experiences, your religion, all of those things in life. And within that, then, is your reality box. And that's where all the information you have resides. And that's the window through which you view reality. Now, if you hear something that is outside of that reality box, you usually say that it's not true, or that the person is hallucinating, or they're crazy, or they're trying to deceive you, or all kinds of things. And even if it happens to be the perception of your own senses, then you assume that you are hallucinating, or perhaps you're going over the deep end. But what we have found out here in the last better than 4 years on this program, that isn't true. That isn't necessarily true. And that the reality box through which most of us view reality is nothing more than a peephole rather than a window that it should be. So tonight we want to stretch your reality box a little bit, and to help us is, for an encore appearance tonight, Dr. Lawrence Boren. Larry, welcome aboard to Open Mind tonight.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here again, Bill.
Now, Larry has a few things that will work on your reality box a little bit, like the world is really upside down, turvy, and crazy, right? We just do it all wrong. Now, Larry, we have a highly technological society going on.
Mm-hmm.
It's rather pristine. It seems to be working rather well. We're able to do a lot of things. And certainly have a lot of things on the boards and a lot of things coming down the pike and down the line. How in the world can we create this great technology that we're looking at if we have it backwards?
It's a very strange situation. I must admit it's strange. When I first found it in my science research, dealing with magnetism and gravity and so on, I couldn't understand. I mean, they would say, okay, it works by the same mathematical equations, whether you view it this way or that way. The mathematics seems to be right. Why is it upside down? Well, let's just take for a moment gravity, okay? Now, I happen to be a believer that it's not just important whether things work, but what is most important to the life of mankind is whether we understand what's happening in this world. I mean, we're here to gain understanding, hopefully, and wisdom and that sort of thing. You know, that's the only thing we're going to take with us, basically, is wisdom and understanding and a few other inner qualities and attainments. We're not going to take the technology with us or the materialism of any kind or any degree. So what's very important is to see if we can understand the laws and the principles that govern the universe we live in. Now, does that sound unreasonable?
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Uh-huh. Okay. So, if I'm able to prove, for example, that gravity is a downward push instead of a downward pull, even though it obeys the same mathematical equation, I still consider that an advancement in understanding and wisdom and understanding what's actually happening.
Now, I have a question for you, just offhand.
Of course.
A gentleman just published a number of papers, particularly in the Register.
Right, I saw that.
About gravity.
Uh-huh.
I had a chance to talk to him for a few minutes. I didn't have a chance to get to him to any great detail. And he even bought time on this radio station concerning that. Did you read his paper on gravity, and do you agree with him or disagree with him?
I had quite a struggle trying to get a hold of that paper, but I finally did. And I read it very carefully two or three times. Okay. I would say he has an interesting approach. He uses the atomic level approach of that atoms, the atomic structure itself, atomic forces create the gravitational reaction. But the interesting thing, I could agree with him on his basic concept, but it's just that in that article, which was a whole page in a newspaper, he did not reveal really the technique behind what he was driving at. He just hinted at it. He said, in effect, that gravity is the interaction between the atomic structure of every atom and the ambient energy that fills all space. Aha! That is significant.
Now, we've talked about that ambient energy quite often. It has a number of names that range from radiant energy to diatom energy to whatever. Is that the same kind of energy you think he's talking about? all-pervasive sea of energy that we live in?
That some have called the ether, according to the new definition of the ether.
I think that's what Einstein referred to it as.
He referred to it, of course, as the time-space continuum, but actually Einstein imbued it with a certain materiality, if I may say so. Now, may I pursue that for one couple of seconds? Einstein actually said that if space can be deformed by the presence of large celestial bodies, right? Mm-hmm. Can be deformed. Now, when you attribute anything, give it the capacity to be deformed or warped, he sometimes called it, and into a curved nature, to a curved degree, from a flat or straight degree to a curved degree, you're attributing a material reality to that time-space continuum, see? And therefore, I say, you must apply Newton's third law of motion, which is that for every action in one direction, there has to be an action equal and opposite, equal in force, but opposite in direction. That, for some strange reason, Einstein didn't quite get to that point. So he didn't recognize any forces operating in his gravity theory.
Do you agree with Newton on that?
No, see, actually, the conclusions I arrived at was sort of a blending of Einstein and Newton's thinking sort of together.
Newton was very definite about it. Einstein was vague about it. And you've kind of come up in the middle between the two, is that?
Well, I found a way to reconcile, in a sense, or integrate their two points of view to some degree. That's a portion of Newton's thinking and teaching, which is called the third law of motion. See, that says that any force moving in one direction will experience a reactive force moving in the other direction. So that if objects called celestial objects, stars and planets, deform space in an outward direction, see, which on our planet Earth here is upwards from the surface, then it will experience a reactive force that will be from space itself, mind you, pushing downwards. Now, for those who believe in the ether theory of some sort, whether it's the neutrino ether or the electron positron ether or some other kind of an ether, it's filled with ambient energy, as this gentleman called it. And that ambient energy then reacts and becomes the vehicle for this reacting force that's going to press downwards, mind you, to meet the force that's pressing upwards against it.
Well, the main reason I mention that, Larry, is that I've received a lot of calls since that article appeared.
Aha, I should have.
And I wish I could remember the gentleman's name. I met him.
Waltman, wasn't it? Or something
yes,
like that.
Something like that.
Waltman.
And there may be some calls to you because you do want to talk about gravity. You think we have the world upside down in terms of the way we are
understanding
or assessing
right.
gravity.
Right. Even though the mathematics remains the same, but still, I think it's very important.
Would it be safe to say that most people feel or have been taught that gravity is the result of the pull of this planet on all things?
Yes.
That we're within the sphere of its size and dimension
right.
and its weight or its
right.
atomic weight.
Its mass, as they call it.
Or mass.
Right. That's what we've been taught. And, you know, when Einstein read Newton's theory on this, he reacted violently eventually or gradually as he thought about it more and more against Newton's concept there.
We found out a curious thing, for instance, on our flights to the moon. We figured we knew what the mass of the moon was, and we figured we knew what the mass of the Earth was, and therefore we knew where the masses of the two planets would equalize each other.
Yeah.
That was a certain point in space.
Yeah.
And we found out that the moon had much greater mass than we thought because that point was much closer to the Earth than we thought it would be.
I heard something about that. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Excuse me, further away from the Earth than we thought it would be.
Possibly further, yes.
Yeah.
I think that's very fascinating. Did you have a further question to pursue on the...
No, I want you to go ahead with why we've got the idea of gravity upside down.
Okay. Well, the question is a very moot question. I've tried to argue it with some physicists and scientists. And, of course, the basic thing I find always with scientists is they are the, you know, they are the high priests of this new wisdom called science in the last 200 or 300 years. And if you haven't taken their exact courses of training and brainwashed your brain in a certain way to see things their way and put on their kind of glasses to look at reality, you just don't know nothing, you see, about reality.
Well, Larry, is that unfair? People that are trained in science should be able to talk about science and speak with it with some authority. I would feel more comfortable with a person doing that than had they been trained in banking and start telling me about physics
or
medicine or whatever.
Yeah, you'd think so. But the strange thing is that a true understanding of nature is not derived from the left brain alone, and that is the brain that the scientist uses 98% of the time, with few exceptions. Einstein, I would say, probably used 50-50 from his left and right brain, and perhaps Newton did too. and a few of the others. But 99% of them use only their left brain. You cannot attain understanding by using your left brain alone. That's the basic. As simple as that. Einstein mm-hmm. knew it, and I think Newton and a few others have found it.
Tesla certainly knew.
Tesla certainly knew. In other words, they received their greatest enlightenment and insights into the workings of nature through the right brain, talking to their left brain. And then they use the left brain to supply all the specifics and the details of the data that tends, finally, to support what their right brain reveals.
All right, before we take a break, where have we got it upside down about gravity? The idea that the Earth is pulling?
It's interesting because Newton, as anyone who investigates very closely, really had no evidence whatsoever to support this notion. It was purely a speculation, which Einstein finally caught him on, so to speak. But this was purely speculation that there is this attracted pull in all matter, such as from the center of the Earth, that is pulling everything downwards towards the center of the Earth. But why should we worship this notion when there's absolutely not a shred of evidence to support that particular claim? The evidence for the law, the force law that he used, the gravity force law, that it varies as the square of the distance or the inverse square of the distance, it tends to work out exactly that way. But strangely enough, before Newton, there was Kepler and William Gilbert of England, who both developed a solar force law acting on the planets, only it was a magnetic force. And it worked by the same law, the same inverse square law. So what do you think of that? There you have an entirely different force acting, but using the same mathematics.
Well, I'm curious about one thing, Larry. Now, NASA, for instance, whenever they send flights to the moon and send flights to the planets and beyond, and to all of them, and they do it very, very successfully, they use a science that very roughly is known as orbital mechanics in order to do that.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we just whipped a satellite around the moon so it could go off and do something else we wanted to do, using the laws of orbital mechanics. And those laws are basically built upon Newton's theory. And yet they seem to work.
Yeah, but you see, Einstein had the same mathematics, but in basically a different approach entirely. He also rejected this downward pull idea. And what my point is that Einstein developed this new notion of curved space, that every celestial object is curving the space around it. But no scientist that I could talk to could ever quite explain to me what Einstein's ultimate picture of the gravity force was. In fact, every single textbook says that Einstein did not deal with a force at all. And so that's where I take exception with Einstein. See, I'm saying that Einstein should have used a little bit of Newton's ideas, and that one called the third law of motion is very important and significant, because Einstein was using a force from the Earth and every celestial body pressing on his space-time continuum. See, exerting a force on it. You can't deny that. I mean, no scientist can deny that. If Einstein was here right this moment, I don't think he could worm out of that one.
Well, what would you say gravity is right now, then?
Well, you see, it's the reactive force coming from the space-time continuum, if you want to use Einstein's term, or from the etheric substance that fills all space, which is made of ambient energy, in the terminology of Mr. Waltman there. So, you see, it's like a material, a substance. This ether is like a substance. And when it's distorted by physical substance, it reacts with a physical force. See, even though it is non-physical itself, in essence, it is non-physical. We're calling it etheric substance or space-time continuum. But it obeys this material law, nevertheless. When it's pushed on in one direction, it pushes back. And that's the pushing back is the gravity force.
In other words, I'm able to sit in this chair because something's pushing down on me rather than something is pulling down on me.
That's it, exactly. Now, isn't that opposite? Isn't that one is opposite to me?
That's rather the other way that I would have been taught, of course, to believe that.
It's a pressure pushing down on us.
Until I started doing this show, Larry, and I've learned to not believe anything. And to believe everything.
And to believe everything.
And at the same time, it's sort of upside down this way. Sort of an upside down person. Do you have another upside down, topsy turvy thing that you'd like to get into? I want you to get into it after we take just a very short break.
Oh, yeah.
And then we'll go to the callers, because I think they want to talk to you about a number of things that you've said before.
They might.
And
they might.
You may have to say tonight.
Turn had created and evolved itself out of nothing. That's point one. That's upside down. I mean, to those who have an intuitive approach to these things, Point two, it did so without any plan, purpose, or design, just mechanically and purely through chance and random accident. That's what they teach us, and that's what they teach in all the schools and colleges. Point three, therefore, there's nothing sacred about the universe or any part of it. No awe-inspiring higher power of any kind to be concerned about or to relate to. Point four, therefore, such ideas as God, spirit, soul, cosmic mind, creator, or the evolution of consciousness, those such concepts are totally invalid. The world of matter alone is real.
Now, Larry, do you really feel that there are a lot of people who do not believe that there is a creative force that is far greater than the human mind out there at work?
Well, in my study
I have to disagree with you. I think that most people will accept the fact that this is not all happenstance.
Yeah, but my point is this. This is what the education system is set up to teach to the pupils and students that go through it. And it's under the influence of the scientists that they do so. I mean, I'm not saying that all the students end up buying this. At some point in their life, maybe in their 20s or 30s, they throw out a lot of what they've learned in the school system and say, well, it really isn't that way at all. But nevertheless, there is a subtle brainwashing going on, and I say it's a conspiracy, my friend. I really do believe that. There are a lot of conspiracies out there. And
well, we can look at our school system, and we know that something has been happening, that we have now probably produced the worst school system on the planet.
Yes, exactly.
And if somebody wants to challenge me on that, I would welcome it, but this is not the forum for it.
Right, right.
But it's hard for me to believe, really, that too many people are accepting that all of this is just science. Naturally, you know, I deal with a lot of very, very scientific people.
Mm-hmm.
And
but those
I don't know
the
one
science.
Yet who doesn't agree that there is something incredible out there that has fashioned all of this or set up the rules and regulations or the laws upon which all of this came about.
But I think you're dealing mainly with what we call New Age scientists, or those who participate in this new trend of thinking. You're not dealing with the orthodox mind of science, because I've dealt with a lot of them. I've read thousands of pages of their material, and they totally believe in the worship of materialism. I want to call a spade, if I may, and that's what I'm calling it. That's what they teach in all the textbooks and all the courses, 99% of the time. There may be occasionally an exception in a teacher or professor who is willing to suggest the idea that maybe there is some kind of a higher power out there, but he's generally censored if he says very much in that direction. That's the way I understand it, Bill, and I've followed this for many years. And I will call a spade. That's the way I see it. That's the way I found it to be. Now, I find it
very difficult to argue with you, because when I was in the school system was some years ago.
Yeah.
And certainly in the science classes that I was in, that was always understood that there was a greater power out there.
Really?
But we were dealing with, as far as the science that we were dealing with, the things that we were able to observe, see, and understand.
Mm-hmm.
And this was simply from human observation. We were never able to understand, for instance, why that a female could have a baby. We just accepted the fact that that was God's business, and there it was, and it did its thing. Now we understand a great deal more about it than we did in the 50s whenever I was studying these things. But are you telling me now that as time has gone on, we have excluded the higher power, and of course all of this is the working of the movement of molecules.
That's precisely what they try to say, even in behavioristic psychology, which still rules the roost in psychology. No, they teach that thoughts and feelings and ideas and so on are nothing but chemical reactions in the brain from molecular combinations that strangely create these strange fantasies or inner workings of the mind, but they do not attribute any reality.
Just molecules and electrons going out there and having a heyday, and we end up being the recipient of all of these little emotions that we feel and feelings that we feel and
right.
All of that.
All the evolution of pure accident and random happenings. It all goes back to the Heisenberg principle of uncertainty, that everything is kind of random in the universe, basically.
Do you really feel that a lot of people buy that?
I feel that 95% of the brainwashed scientists certainly absolutely do buy that.
You're talking about the scientific community, then.
Yeah, the scientific community, by and large, except the exception, which is the New Age scientist that has... He introduces the faculty called intuition into his thinking, see, from the right brain. And then he comes up with a whole new perspective. But, Bill, that is not found in the usual scientist who writes the textbooks and gives the lectures and so on. So I am protesting against the science establishment to that extent that they undermine, in fact, they laugh at the concept of a right brain or intuitive mind or higher mind or anything like this.
But I find the government now talking about right brain and left brain and some of their things that they're putting out. And, you know, whenever the government starts talking about it, that we've had to do about 50 years of a cell job somewhere down the line.
Well, I'd like you to show me some of those papers. They can't even accept the reality of UFOs, for example, after 10 million sightings or some such.
Well, they spend billions of dollars on it, but publicly they're not saying anything about it yet. That's next week's show, by the way. Bill Moore will be here, and we'll go into that. We understand that when the government talks about UFOs that you're listening to Hot Air.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the way it's going to be for a while, but hopefully that will change.
Oh, yes, in time it's got to change. So there's another thing I could go into for a moment about my discovery in the realm of color theory. Would that be of any interest on the Upside Down?
You do that because our lines are filling up. They want to talk to you, but go ahead and do the color theory thing.
Just real quick, I believe you recall, I've now placed them into a little slide mounts. I'm going to keep this a little bit in the realm of mystery. I'm just going to say that I've been able to demonstrate to anyone's visual perceptions. It's not a theory or something you can debate and argue about.
We're trying to do television on radio tonight, but we'll do it.
Right. So if I place these up to your eye anyway, let's just say I have something that is yellow in color and something that is blue in color. And I can either make green out of this combination, or I can make, lo and behold, by magic, I can make red out of yellow and blue, as well as green. Now, if that is true, and if you wish to look again, you have seen it yourself, and I've shown it to quite a few dozens of people. You know, your senses tell you, well, that's certainly absolutely a fact. I'm looking at pure green at this moment, and then a few seconds later, I'm looking at pure red from yellow and blue, nothing less. And this, most people will agree, definitely turns topsy-turvy the Newtonian theory of color.
Could I have those two slides? Because I have as a guest with me, who came in tonight, a gentleman who's in television. He works with NBC. But that's all right. He knows color television. He knows color. And you put yellow and blue together, what color do you get?
Green.
You get green? Put those yellow and blues together.
You've got to also next go to those. Add those in.
Oh, I have to add these in?
Yeah.
I tell him what to do over there then.
Mm-hmm.
I have Mr. Clint Houston with me tonight from NBC in Houston.
I see.
Mr. Houston from Houston.
Oh, great. Now, you've got to look up at a bright light, a bright white light. And remember, these are not pure white, but they're close to it. It works much better with the sunlight, which is 99% pure white light. And you'll find even...
That is indeed green.
Right.
Absolutely.
We're not getting the right color out of that.
No, wait a minute. Put the four together. Did you get the four?
That's two.
That's two, yeah.
That's green.
Okay. Okay, the other two are green also.
Now we have red.
Should you?
I never knew that.
You've been dealing with color television cameras for years and years, right, Clint?
Yes.
That shouldn't work, should it?
No.
Yellow and blue should never make red, according to all the books I've ever read. And
that's just an amazing red that you get out of that, isn't it?
It's a pure red. It's quite a pure red. It's not an off red or some hallucination that might... Some might call it.
Possibly you will show this on television.
Maybe you'll want to do that yourself, in fact. That is quite a phenomenon.
I think so.
But it's part of the upside-down, topsy-turvy world we live in. That's not supposed to happen. Primary colors produce, whenever they're combined, primary colors. But I think Dr. Boren is showing us that that doesn't happen.
In fact, I'm showing you right here, by the way, just final summing it up. Two primaries can make a third primary. That's another way of putting it, which isn't ever supposed to happen.
Okay.
See, yellow and blue are primaries, and red is a primary.
Mm-hmm.
So two primaries should never make a third primary. And what it's suggesting, my friend, is simply quite awe-inspiring, and that is that maybe, just maybe, if we had the right facilities, we could prove that two colors, yellow and blue, could create the entire spectrum of color on television with two layers of color only instead of three, and two color cameras, and two layers in color printing and color photography would perhaps only be necessary to deliver the full gamut of colors.
Or don't some of the systems do that now, using a magenta color and another one of those off colors, electron gun
No, I have never heard projectors. Of one that's using two.
One of the Japanese uses that. I forgot what it is.
I don't.
The one at home, I've got three big things.
I think they all use three, Mel. The only one that's dared to even suggest that there might be a way of using two is Edwin Land of the Land Polaroid Corporation, and he has an entirely different approach to this, and it isn't yellow and blue.
All right, you ready to go to the callers now?
Oh, I suppose so. Maybe they'll have some interesting reactions.
Well, I find out that the callers are far more better interrogators than I am.
Oh.
You know, I just kind of sit here and play traffic cop.
Well, you do a little bit more than that.
All right. Hal is on the line. Hal, welcome aboard.
Good evening. Before I get to my question, I was a little unclear about your discussion of the Heisenberg principle. You know, you mentioned that had to do with the universe being random. And my understanding was that it had to do with uncertainty, not being able to prove something under an experiment, because by experimenting it on something, you change it automatically. Is that what the Heisenberg principle is about?
That's what it has come to mean in the later interpretations. That's not quite what Heisenberg had in mind in 1926, approximately, when he came up with it. Purely that you can't measure, he said, momentum and the position of an atomic or subatomic particle at the same time. Well, that may, or yeah, I can understand why he said it. It would be a very difficult thing to measure. But my point is, I'll go along with Einstein, who came out later, a few years later, with two other physicists. They wrote an article in which they brought up the concept that there could well be hidden variables that are controlling the behavior of the electrons, rather than just a randomness that can never be called deterministic, that isn't based on cause and effect.
But we haven't located what the factors are affecting the subatomic particles, though.
Uh-huh. That's what they say, and they are right, they haven't, but I'm audacious enough to say that I have located it.
Dr. Boren has an idea that just may astound you.
Mm. Yeah, well...
Are you ready for it, Hal?
Oh, absolutely. I'm ready.
Well, maybe... I don't know if the whole physics community is, but we first came here a year or so ago, a year and a month ago almost, and we brought forth the notion that we've located the fundamental magnetic particle, or the fundamental, yes, that's what I should call it, the fundamental magnetic particle that creates both magnetism and what I call the magnetic electric approach to all phenomena in the universe, and it's called the positron.
You know what the positron is, huh?
I've heard of it. It can only exist in conjunction with something else. Is that what it is? I'm not sure. I'm really not that. I've heard of it, though.
Well, let us take time out to give them a thumbnail sketch of the positron.
Real quick, you're basically right that it is considered not to exist outside of nuclear phenomena. It is actually, now I will now present my concept of the proton, you see. I'm saying that the proton derives its plus one charge from the presence of a positron within it, even though I guess almost every physicist in the world will disagree with me and say the positron doesn't exist in the proton until it suddenly collides with another proton or a neutron, and then one positron suddenly leaves, and they'll say, well, that positron was manufactured at the moment of ejection, or in other words, just suddenly appeared out of nothing. Okay, well, I don't buy that. I say that the positron is what gives the proton its plus one charge, and it's giving a plus one magnetic charge and not an electric charge. And this plus one charge of the proton that's derived from the positron is what sets up a magnetic field at the center of every hydrogen atom and in every...
other atom.
Every other atom in the universe, that is all the elements, which are based on the presence of protons, like, two protons in helium plus two neutrons and so on up the scale. And in every case, one of those protons is controlling one electron that, because it sets up at right angles to the magnetic field of the proton derived from the positron, it sets up an electric field according to the Faraday magnetic law of magnetic electric induction. So there's an induced electric field, and that's the field that the electron pursues in its pathway around the atom, and also accounts for its precessional motion, as called a precessing orbit. So I'm sorry, I don't agree with Heisenberg that the electron doesn't know what it's quite doing in the in going around the nucleus, going around the in the atom. That's the picture that we have still in quantum theory. You know, that the electron doesn't know what the hell it's doing. It's just going sort of staggering around randomly and can never be pinpointed as to where it's going or any pathway that it's going.
But it's doing a lot of work in our society.
It's doing a heck of a lot of work for staggering around as though it were intoxicated.
Well, for those folks that watch radio with pictures, they wouldn't have it without the electron. And indeed, they wouldn't even have cables. They wouldn't have the electronics.
We wouldn't have anything in the electrical or electronic age of technology without the control of controlled motion of the electron, which is definitely never.
But the positron, you say, is basically a magnetic force instead of an electromagnetic force.
Yeah, I must clear that up, Bill. You're not saying it quite exactly 100% correctly. It's a magnetic electric particle, whereas the electron is an electromagnetic particle. One has a preponderance of magnetic energy, the positron. The other has a preponderance of electrical energy.
Now, Tony Sarantinis over in Phoenix will tell us that the positron has simply a coating on it that is magnetic rather than electromagnetic, but the core of it is electromagnetic.
Ah, okay. So we will have to we will part company a little bit there. I will say that the core...
But its properties become basically magnetic in so doing, mm-hmm. which changes the way that electrons flow from a plus to minus pole.
See, I arrive at this purely from analyzing the rest energy of the positron versus the rest energy of the electron. And the rest energy of the positron is definitely magnetic, and the rest energy of the electron is 100% definitely electrical. And each one, when they go into motion, they develop the opposite field.
Okay. Does that help you, Hal? Because I don't want us to get into deep physics here.
No, this is very super.
Well, I
want you to know that I'm a journalist, and I don't understand a great deal of all of this.
Well, I think it cleared up what the Heisenberg was originally trying to point out, and also it's interesting that you say that the path of an electron or the motion of an electron is predicated on the presence of the positron.
Mm-hmm.
I hope I absorbed it. But actually, I had a question that it was directed towards the original conversation of the program here,
mm-hmm.
which was that Doctor. It says that what we should be seeking is understanding, not just the fact that the technology works and that the electricity flows through the copper and we turn on our TV and the picture comes on, but we should be looking for deeper questions and answers as to how and why things work in the first place.
Very good.
And my question is, how would this affect life on Earth? I mean, would it affect the quality of our life? Would it affect our consciousness or the material things around us? What would you say we have?
What is it? What are you referring to? It.
Well, the pursuit of the understanding. For instance, you say that the understanding that gravity is a push, the counter motion of the space being warped, the counter force. I'm sorry, of the warp.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the counter force of the warped space. Well, you say that it won't affect the mathematics of gravity computations, the inverse square root, and things like that. And so therefore it wouldn't actually radically change all the mathematics. So how would it change our lives?
What value is all this information is what you're asking.
Yeah, and the understanding.
All right.
I think that will come out in time. It's not something we can easily formulate at this time. For one thing, it enlarges our understanding of the significance of this etheric substance that fills all space, which is also called ambient energy.
Mm-hmm.
It has much greater power than we have dared to believe it had before.
Would this be the source of the quote-unquote infinite energy source that Tesla technology is heading towards?
I think in a way we're talking about those same things.
I think it borders on that.
Wilhelm Reich called it orgon energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
T. Henry Morey called it radiant energy. There have been a number of names for this energy.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, it's something of an enormous study on the part of the scientific community now working for the government.
Right.
But to answer your question, I think, Hal, we're looking at a technology on this planet Earth which is, at best, extremely primitive.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. All right. That would really hurt the egos of the scientists.
Well, nevertheless, it is.
Yes.
It's extremely primitive.
Right.
And I'm not trying to say anything other than where it's going to be. And as the technology becomes more and more precise, and you start building a technology on something that has worked in the past but may be not exactly right but worked before,
mm-hmm.
it becomes more and more important that we understand the real workings of what makes the universe work.
Yes.
If we're going to build our technology upon it.
Exactly.
Now, we've gotten by because we're extremely primitive. But as we move into a highly technological and sophisticated kind of technology that allows us to do some of the things that are on the drawing boards right now, we have to make damn sure that our technology is correct, or we're going to make a lot of very, very serious mistakes in the future.
That's the whole thing right there.
Yes.
Does that make any sense to you?
It really does. And can I have a parting shot?
Sure.
I think that the danger is the roadblock that keeping us to making those strides to and progress of technology is specialization. I don't know if that's the only thing that's keeping us from making that progress. It could be stubborn minds, too. But that I think the two go hand in hand. People are so one-track minded in their area of expertise. Yeah, they don't see across the boundaries that, of interrelationships between disciplines, and that would make these people less likely to open their minds.
Specialization is a very good point, because there was a time that was good, but now all things, as you even mentioned there, Hal, interrelate to the others in such an incredible way that specialization is probably passé.
Well, thank you for both your comments.
Larry wanted to say one thing, and then we're going to go.
Yeah.
Yes. Now take the what's called the atomic bomb blast. When they're testing, when they've been testing atomic bombs off and on for the last 20 years, 25 years. You see, I believe that when you set off one of these blasts, any kind of a nuclear blast, you're affecting this space-time continuum or etheric energy envelope that surrounds the Earth with this tremendous blast going upwards, and it's going to, therefore, if what I'm saying is correct, it's going to cause a downward pressure of some enormous degree that will not necessarily go back to the same exact point on the Earth, but will affect, let's say, the atmosphere and the possibly the Van Allen radiation belts and the ozone layer and various things surrounding the Earth in ways that we haven't the slightest notion about, in adverse ways, because we're creating this, call it a negative force moving outwards, a blasting force that is totally unnatural and unplanned and unwanted by nature. And nature is going to react in some way violently against us when we play these crazy tricks on nature.
Okay, Hal?
Yes, I hope you're wrong, but I have a gut level feeling you're right.
All right. That's what we're all about here, is to give you something to chew upon.
Okay.
All right, now. Thank you very much for listening and chewing just a bit. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Bill Jenkins. With me, Dr. Lawrence Boron. He's telling me I'm coming from left field at him here tonight. Come on, Larry. I'm not either. We just sit here and want to talk about the upside-down world.
Yeah, you're getting into it, all right.
All right. Alan, I think, wants to talk to us. Alan, welcome aboard. What's on your mind tonight?
How are you doing today?
Well, we're sitting here cooking.
Well, I wish I could say that. I'm freezing. That's one of my questions. I was wondering if you had any insight as to changing weather. I noticed in Southern California in the last 10 years from sort of a steady climate of you could count on heat during the summer and a rather cool in the winter, but no one knows how to dress anymore. You get up and it's freezing, and an hour later it's about 20 degrees warmer.
You missed the show last week, didn't you?
I guess I did, yes.
Yeah, Lowell Ponte was with me. Lowell wrote a book called The Cooling. And back in 1976, he was telling you to get heavier wear for Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And it turned out that Lowell was absolutely, as he always is, exactly right.
But is there any scientific notion on what's causing this this apparent weather change in this area?
There is something called the El Nino effect that has been noticed by and commented on by scientists about a year to 2 years ago. Started where they began noticing that certain, let's say, motions of wind currents in the upper atmosphere were reversing themselves from their usual pattern, which they have observed once in a while to some small degree before, but I think this was greater than ever before, beginning about a year and a half ago. And apparently it's responsible for greater extremes in both heat in summer and cold in winter. It's reversed.
Is it peculiar to Southern California?
No. It's, for example, haven't you read that in Europe in the last 2 or 3 months they've had the warmest winter, I believe, for a long, long time, while we were going through the coldest winter of 70 years or so. They were going through one of the warmest winters maybe in 70 years. So something is screwing things up, obviously, in the weather patterns.
Well, what Lowell will tell you is that for the last 15 or 20 years, which is a geological twinkling, the Earth has been under what is known as a tremendous heat wave, which is terribly abnormal for the Earth.
Will it?
And that heat wave is now receding, and we're going back down. We're seeing a cooling of the Arctic mass, in fact, 1 or 2 degrees. That's offset a little bit by the man-made greenhouse effect that we see going on right now. However, the greenhouse effect probably is being overblown, according to Lowell, a little bit, simply because we are now cycling down from this enormous heat wave that we have had. Now, on a global scale, you could look at of us having to go through here in Southern California a month or two of 100 and better degrees during the summertime. Well, that's what the whole planet has been going down. And according to Lowell, we're getting back down to where we should be. And the skirt begins to move further and further southward, the skirt being where the warm air from the equator hits the cold air from the Arctic. That's where that comes together, is known as the skirt, and it sort of undulates all the way across the top of the planet or the bottom of the planet if you're in the southern hemisphere from the from the Arctic side.
Yeah.
And that certainly radically affects weather and where the rains will fall and that sort of thing. If you look back at weather records that go back 50, 60, 70 years ago, you'll see that this weather is not abnormal at all. We have just been in an abnormal period.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the last year and a half or so, we have been feeling the effects of the great volcanic eruptions at Mount St. Helens and the one down in Mexico, which for parts of the North American continent reduced the amount of energy that came from the sun. It was just blocked off 10-15% in some places, and so that naturally brought on even more cooling weather because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think this shift in pattern affects one if they don't have a, for instance, I'm losing sleep, I noticed, and that I'm trying to put my finger on this. I haven't had, 4 hours sleep in the last 5 days. And I was wondering, I have noticed a cold and warm weather change, and I wanted to know if...
Do you live near the coast, by the way?
No, I live, maybe half an hour from it.
Up in the hills or mountains?
No, in the valley.
In the valley.
In the San Fernando Valley?
Yes.
That's a little unusual. A lot of people along the coast are having problems with sleeping. They're having behavior problems, and at the same time, if they've got certain kind of electronic devices that open and close their garage doors, they're not opening and closing because of a pulsing electromagnetic signal that's coming out from the Pacific Ocean. There's a Russian trawler out there. But we can't say that that's the cause of it, but they're having some enormous problems with electromagnetic devices, particularly in San Diego and up north into the Los Angeles area.
Mm-hmm.
And folks that are living along the coast, if they're experiencing erratic behavior, that probably is where it's coming from.
Yeah, well, this is really helpful. Getting back to my original point, do you think it'll ever revert back the weather in this area to a time, say, before 1976, when you can count on certain seasonal weather?
Well, according to Lowell Bunny,
so.
We're coming out of a heat wave, so no, I don't think you'll see that for a while.
So we can just more or less count on most of the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, Alan. Thank you very much. Don, you're on.
Yes, good evening, gentlemen. Two quick comments and a question for Dr. Boren.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I think that Chuck Waltman would make a very fascinating guest if he were willing to come on your program.
We're going to try to get Chuck on.
Okay. I was in a very select group in early January that had his theories presented. It was about 14 people assembled. And unfortunately, I'm an attorney by trade, and I can't say that I understood it all, but he's a very rational, sane man.
I had a chance to talk to him, and I found him to be, extremely interesting. I make no pretense about the fact that I am non-scientific, but he was making sense to me.
Well, he made a lot of sense to me, and actually showed the presentation of some of the diagrams that he had, the actual models he had that he presented in the article on Newton's birthday, which happens to be Christmas Day.
Yeah, right.
And secondly, I appreciate your show, Bill. I think it's fantastic. I'd love to see your hours extended.
So would I. We're working on that.
Okay.
Maybe it will be.
That sounds like good news. A question for Dr. Boren. I was curious, with his knowledge of gravity, if he saw any way to harness the force and use it for an effective, fast, and inexpensive transportation mode.
Yeah, well, you may be possibly referring to something called the anti-gravity device.
That's correct.
I believe that this new understanding would be very helpful there, although I believe also that the anti-gravity approach is based, as I understand it, more on the magnetic principle, actually using magnetic repulsion, which reverses the gravity force. If you harness the magnetic repulsion force properly. Now, there are some scientists working on this approach, and I believe they are using magnetic repulsion there. So it's just, a little bit different force than the gravity force, but it creates something which we could call an anti-gravity, a reaction or effect. You follow what I'm saying?
Yes, it's a counteracting force.
Yeah, counteracting force, right, that sets aside the law of gravity, as they say.
Exactly. I was just curious if you have any inside knowledge or work with any scientists that are working on that area.
I'm not presently working with any that are working on that. I just occasionally hear of some that are working in that area. But, of course, most of their work is highly secret, until they get what they are after, because we're living in times when anything can be stolen. It's very valuable and very significant, so everyone has to be very cautious about what they're working on.
Of course. I'm curious if in your own mind that it sounds like you do believe in UFOs, obviously, that if you believe that they've harnessed that particular force.
Well, I'll give you a little insight on that. We've had some We've had some sounds of UFOs here. There's no doubt in my mind that we had sounds from something that was not manufactured by the people that were giving us the sounds.
It's no propulsion that we know.
And what we were hearing and analyzing the sound of that were two spinning wheels of some kind going in opposite directions of each other at about 30,000 RPM. Now, those were developing an electromagnetic core, force of energy, which it sounded like they were doing. There is, within that whole kind of energy spectrum, two things turning in opposite directions. You're developing now a very strange movement of electrons and magnetic lines of forces whenever you do that, particularly at that high speed and with that energy.
I have a comment on that. This will be my prediction. I'll predict that the disk rotating one way and the other towards the center will be a plus charge disk, and it will be the, carrying the magnetic energy towards the center and the electrical force towards the outer. When I say magnetic, perhaps I should say the magnetic electric that is predominantly magnetic, secondarily electric, and vice versa on the outer disk.
Now, I can say this from what I know, and I certainly don't claim to know everything, but I've certainly been privy to a lot of information, where we have been able to hear the recordings of these sounds from these strange objects. Who knows where they come from? I assume that they are not exactly from NASA or the Air Force.
Right.
If so, then why are we in the trouble we're in if we have something like that running around?
Mm-hmm.
That this is a common denominator among them all, that seems to be happening. So there is a lot of attention being paid to that very, very question that you asked on. Very perceptive of you, I think.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Appreciate talking to you.
Thank you for calling.
All right, Don, thank you very much. And that gets us out of our first hour. Dr. Lawrence Boren is our guest tonight on Open Mind. We looked at colors that produced a color that shouldn't produce color. Now, you know, I remember my Crayolas in school, and I remember all my training about colors. Now, you gave me, what, six transparencies? They're all blue just a minute ago.
All blue.
Right. You can look through you can look through all the transparencies. They're blue.
Singly alone.
They're blue. Put them all together. There were six, right? Put them up to the light. We have some bright lights in here.
Bright white lights.
And they were red.
Yes.
Now, what is this? What is so strange about the color red? There is no way that I should be able to look through six blue transparencies, all the same color, and get a red image. Now, it's not just me looking at it, it's you looking at it. We have Mr. Clint Houston of NBC in Houston in television. Clint, that's what you were seeing, right?
It's very strange. And we all saw the same thing. It can't be a hallucination.
You're not supposed to see that, are you?
It's no hallucination, then. I thought maybe I was hallucinating. Maybe you would see something different.
Who was the first scientist that discovered that this could be?
All right. The portion that I showed in terms of the blue was discovered by the famous writer who was also an amateur scientist in his day, and finally credited with some new discoveries in the morphology of the plant kingdom, because he was into botany. But he was into many things. His name was Goethe of Germany, who wrote Faust. So believe it or not, he developed a color theory that included this strange discovery that blue colors in dyes, they're called dyes, D-Y-E-S, and they always move toward red, and not only do blue colors move to red, but also yellow colors move to red. However, to my knowledge, he did not get to quite the point of putting yellow and blue together to get red. But
which
he
did earlier tonight.
Which we did earlier tonight. Yeah, okay.
So, yellow and blue equals red.
Yeah, as well as green. You see, we can make it equal green also.
Now, for all of you teachers out there that have been teaching something else opposite to that, we've just been looking at it here, you know.
So, if we're not hallucinating, then we must have experienced reality that is common to all minds and not just to a few.
Well, all of us in the studio are hallucinating, and we've hallucinated with you before on this particular subject. But
yes, and without drugs or anything else.
Just the guard's coffee out at the card shack, you know.
It must have been that. It could have been that.
They do have good coffee out there.
I believe you. I believe you. But the question is, what is responsible for this strange phenomenon? And all I can tell you is this. I haven't solved the entire mystery of color. In all of physics, that's the most difficult mystery to solve. I mean, gravity is easy, and magnetism is easy, and electricity, and understanding all these other things, electromagnetism.
But color gets you.
But color, I can only solve so far about 80% of the mystery.
Is that the reason you're wearing that suit you're wearing tonight?
That's probably the reason I'm wearing this red and white suit that lights up like a Christmas tree, and it is all red. Yeah, this is red and white, and maybe this red is produced by yellow and blue.
But you told me something off the air, and I want you to share with the audience, if you will, about red. Now, we've always been taught that red is at the lower end of the light spectrum as we view it. It's way down.
It's the scientist's view.
It's the scientist's view. And as you get higher in the vibratory rate of light, red goes away and we change into the other colors and end up in ultraviolet, I think.
Next to orange, then yellow, then green, then blue, then violet.
Right. And you say that that's upside down, backwards, topsy-turvy, and wrong.
And the proof is this. I can prove that red is present in every single color of the rainbow, even green.
Red's present in all colors.
All colors. Red is present. And the way I prove it, my friend, is with Kodak's famous, or we'll say their most complete guide to color filters published in the world today, which I have a copy. And they presently have over 100 color filters. These are analyzed by their top spectrophotometry machines. You know, these are $50,000 or $100,000 machines. And they produce curves, you know. That's just what a lot of the scientists worship. They worship these graphs and curves and, you know, plottings. When they can see it out there, the printout or the readout, they say, well, that must be true if the machine says so.
Makes it easier for them anyway.
Yes. So it says right there in black and white, you can see that the red energy is present in all the colors of the spectrum. But they have never called attention to this. It just happens to be something they overlooked.
That's interesting you mentioned. I bought a new Kodak camera, or I was given one for Christmas. Took it away to Fiji, where they didn't have exactly the right film for it, but it was Kodak film.
They should have had Fiji film out there.
I suppose they should. No, that's Fuji.
Oh, I'm sorry. Fuji film. Well, Fuji film on Fiji.
Anyway, all of my pictures turned out red.
Oh, they did.
They all turned out red. And we had enough suntan as it was without having the camera do even more to it.
Oh, I should agree with you.
I'm sorry to get off the subject there, but I just
you threw that in for a little humor. That's nothing wrong with humor.
Well, you know, we're dealing with weighty stuff here.
We've got to be light about it a little bit, especially it deals with light also. Okay, now what's the next question?
Well, in that we have turned all the kindergarten, first grade, second grade, and third grade teachers upside down because they're teaching the kids the wrong thing about color.
Even up to the college professors, too.
And all of the people that are involved in television and photography, that they've got it all wrong about color.
You know, and all the artists and all the spectrophotometrists and so on, physicists and the likewise.
Well, let's go to see what Michael has on his line, on his mind. Where are you, Michael? I think you're right there. Michael?
Yes, hello.
Yeah.
How you doing? First of all, I'd like to say that that anyone who would try and convince me that my mind and consciousness is just the result of some combination of these mysterious elements, that's probably the hardest thing for me to swallow.
It's a bit bizarre, isn't it, Michael?
Well, I have a friend who is attending Harvard right now, and he's a little bit of a radical, what you might call a radical at Harvard, because most of them are very, you know, orthodox as far as the teaching. But
he's in trouble right there, just being at Harvard.
He's in real trouble. He's kind of remained pure-minded about certain things.
For Harvard there, Michael.
Say again?
I said, that's strange for Harvard, but go ahead.
Well, anyway, we were talking about evolution one time, and I telling him some points why I didn't agree with it, and he's been educated up through the school there, and when we got upon the point of his mind, that's where it really got to him. But anyway, that's really aside from what I want to talk about. I want to ask doctor here.
Dr. Boron.
Yes. What do you think about possibly let's see if I can explain this here. Well, we know that the things that are accelerating, or at least moving, I guess acceleration is what you could. Things that are accelerating tend to create something that's like gravity. Like if you were in a rocket accelerating at a certain speed, then you could stand on the back of the rocket, kind of. If you were going at the right acceleration, it might produce a certain amount of G, you know, to whatever it was.
You're talking about vector forces there.
Yeah, gravity force.
Right. Now, what about the Earth and all matter is somehow expanding at some, you know, acceleration that would cause everything standing on, like, a globe that we're here standing on would be more of an acceleration effect?
That's what Einstein was, led to believe in his picture of things. But I ask you, I'd ask Einstein if he was here, Just where is this elevator that we're standing on? Because he used this analogy, and this is what led him into this new point of view on gravity. I'm asking, where is the elevator we're standing on? Because because the planet Earth is traveling in a definite direction. It's called west to east direction, and, you know, on its or on its
relative to the
axis.
Galactic disk.
Well, also on its axis first, the rotation is west to east, and around the sun it's west to east, and then around the galaxy, I believe, it's west to east, always in this direction, which I call the electrical field, established first by the magnetic field. But anyway, the point is that there is this direction of motion. And it's not really an acceleration, according to science. It's a pretty steady, uniform velocity. You know, velocity is uniform motion, and acceleration is non-uniform motion that's going gradually faster and faster and faster.
Right.
Now, I fail to see, really, in Einstein's analogy, how it applies to the planet Earth, in short. That's the whole question. How does an accelerating elevator apply to the planet Earth, where we experience gravity? You see, we're not in an elevator, and I can't see any real, you know, in the Earth, it's nothing like an elevator. It's not like a rocket ship that's going in one direction, you see. If we were accelerating in one direction, you see, gravity force is pushing downward on us. We'd have to be all accelerating upwards from the Earth in all 360 degrees of directions. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well,
for that analogy to operate and be
not all the planets in our solar system though follow the same let's see, what is it, Venus that's going on a backwards rotation, and
rotation is backwards,
and either Neptune or Uranus is got sort of a irregular rotation. It's like a, I don't know, it's like bowling, like it'd be rolling down the plane of the
Uranus
or something.
Uranus, yeah. But
yeah.
They do all revolve in the same direction. At least they have that in common. They all revolve west to east.
Right. I had a thought, and I don't know, you know, it's probably not unique or anything, but, you know, science, you know, years ago the orthodox thinking was, you know, we have this proton and neutron in the center.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the electrons, you know, cruising around the outside, and that was the basic cruising. Those were the basic building blocks of all matter. And then certain things that couldn't be accounted for using those theories, they developed other theories. You know, we have quantum mechanics now, and science has never come to the dead end of the street, being able to unify some complete unification of theory. As a matter of fact, the more they go, the harder it gets. Seemingly,
because they don't have the right data, putting in their input isn't quite correct.
Well, I believe that, you know, the left side of our brain being all symbolic and trying to, you know, categorize things and being, if then, very computerish.
Linear and sequential.
Yes. I don't think that the universe can really be defined going down that path to its true nature.
Absolutely right. Even though we can arrive at a unified field theory, I at least have made an effort in that direction. Among others, hundreds and thousands of scientists are working on that approach. But that will still never give them a true understanding and insight into nature and the universe.
It's a matter of degree to me, as far as how far as you try to explain matter, you know, as far as particles and these different types of phenomena happening. You know, we have these mesons and plutons and gluons.
Good for you.
And we can, you know, they might split these down even further and try and explain all these other little phenomena. But the thing is, they just keep getting more of the same types of things, and I just don't think I just don't think there'll ever be an end to that road.
Well, let me just mention, and I'd like to comment on that. Here's my argument with these particle physicists, they're called, dealing in high energy. Okay, they keep creating more high energy accelerators. You know, it's all done in these accelerators.
Right.
They build them miles and miles long, and they take a beam, usually almost always a beam of electrons colliding with a beam of positrons. Believe it or not, you'll find that 80 or 90% of the time that's the input they give. Okay, then they come out with, they say, well, the higher energy we impart to them, the more we get strange particles at the end of the collision.
Yeah.
And so they start giving these particles different names because they come out with different energy levels. Yet, here's the mystery. They all decay back into electrons and positrons. If you analyze carefully, as I have, what are the decay products of all these particles that they create, or resonances at a higher and higher energy, they all decay back to the same two fundamental particles from which they originated. Now, if that doesn't prove that the electron and positron are the fundamental particles, I don't know what's up or down.
That's interesting. I haven't thought about that.
I mean, it's so obvious that they can't see what's obvious.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you like, something else here.
I want you to make it very quick, Michael. We have a lot of people in the line.
Yeah. Okay. I'm, you know, I don't really have any clear-cut proof or belief about what I think the nature of the universe is, but I seem to go down the road that there's no such thing as the nothingness that people want to think about as far as space. I think that space is something, and that possibly,
absolutely,
you know, matter is just little, you know, gyrations in this, mm-hmm, in this big thing.
It's a very dynamic place in which we play a very, very minute role.
And you know what the mystics of old called it? They call it the plenum. Instead of the emptiness, they call it the fullness. Plenum,
yes,
means fullness, and that's where part of the mystery of God or the divine nature lies, in the omnipresence of space.
It's amazing how very wise the ancients were. They were supposed to be very dumb, but didn't they? Like,
yeah,
very wise.
We're learning how wise they were. They keep learning how...
It's like the young man who, whenever he gets 21, he realizes that all at once his father must have gone to school.
Right. Very interesting.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Michael, thank you very much for being with us tonight. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's Open Mic. Chuck, what's on your mind tonight?
Yes, hello, Bill.
Hi.
My golly, first-time caller here.
Well, where have you been?
Usually on Saturday nights, I'm very lucky. My lady is busy tonight, and I am calling you. I hear you going home usually, and I just want to say that I'm glad I'm talking to you right
well,
now.
Well, listen, if we can stand in for your lady tonight, I guess that
you never could.
Something.
You never could. Let's get on with it. Okay, when I first called, Dr. Boren just intrigued me enormously, because I thought, you may have been quoting your old age or your conventional scientist, but that there was no essential source of energy. And I just want to say to you, I'm your basic life insurance agent. I'm 49 years old. I am not dumb. I'm not particularly smart. I'm somewhere away from where you are right now.
I am suspect of all of us that are 49 years old.
Okay, well, in any event, I'm just saying to you, all I know is what I see, experience, and I believe everything, and I disbelieve everything. It has to happen before anything comes true to me. And I was in a group, when I lived in Orange County, I was in a group of people that included a couple of scientists, a metallurgist, teachers, booksellers, all kinds of people. And every week we got together. And it was a fascinating experience, because I haven't done that since I was divorced, but nonetheless, that was where I was, and it was a fascinating thing, and it had to do with tapping into an energy source or something, whatever that was. It worked. We bent metal, and I did. You want to bend a fork? Heck, I can bend a fork for you. Nothing to it. It had to do with remote viewing,
mm-hmm,
like in another room. It had to do with bending copper strips mentally without touching them.
Right.
I couldn't do that, but others could. An 11-year-old kid bending a tempered aluminum bar.
Have you dissipated a cloud yet?
No.
Well, we're doing that.
I don't know what you're talking about.
No, you're looking to concentrate on a cloud and make it go away.
Well, I don't disbelieve it, and I don't believe it. I would just have to do that.
That's a very simple thing to do.
Well, okay, I agree that that's probably possible, but I haven't seen it done. But nonetheless, the idea was that, it is, as far as I'm concerned, that I believe what happens. And what happens with me is that when you talk about hitting a tennis ball or a golf ball or, God, making love, anything, just when you tap and you open up and get your mind out of the way, all sorts of good things happen. And there is, as far as I'm concerned, there is a force. There is a universe, I don't know what it is, but there is a force. There is energy available to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get the junk out of the way, it just kind of flows through. And I may have misunderstood or misheard Dr. Boren early on, because in the last hour, it's been an hour now, and I hope you're satellite. If you aren't, it's a damn shame. Are you?
We're going to be.
Good. Oh, God, I'm glad to hear that. But nonetheless, when I heard him say that everything was matter and it was just very clinical and all that sort of stuff, heck, I know better than that. And I just simply can't buy that. I think in hearing him in the last hour, that probably he was just reciting some of the old science or the conventional science.
Of course, of course.
You're one of our people, Chuck. There's no doubt about that. You're talking about the energy created by the mind.
First time you and I have talked, and I tell you, I've been with you, Jenkins, man, and I hope the heck you go national, I'll tell you.
There
are people in Princeton I know about, scientists from up in Stanford that have come down to the group that I was with, and back from there in Duke, and very fascinating, interesting people, and I'm not a simple person, I'm not dumb, but I am a person, I'm not a scientist. and your previous caller, Sal, and the young man that preceded me. I am not a physicist. I try to understand what they're saying. But all I know is what works.
You've triggered some mind energy, and that's probably one of the most awesome energy sources that we
have.
Yeah,
that's right.
And it's right brain energy, mind energy.
You betcha, and I'll bend a fork for you anytime you want.
Oh, great.
Let me give you a little experiment, Chuck. You like to play those games.
Yes, I do. It's a game, really.
Well, we're going to use your mind.
Okay.
Get a stick and wipe one end of it so that you can balance it on a fulcrum of some sort, whether it's the edge of a glass or anything like that, where you've got it perfectly balanced.
Oh, hey, I've done that already.
All right, then point your fingers at it, tense them a little bit, and watch that thing spin.
And juice it, you betcha.
It'll just go round and round and round.
It works. It absolutely works.
Now, we're not talking about heat energy. We're not talking about wind energy.
I don't know what it is. I don't even care.
Well, we had that rather well detailed for us by Dr. Patrick Flanagan, who taught me how to do that.
I don't know him. I know Tesla and some woman, doctor that is involved in this sort of thing. I think she came down from the acceleration type thing up at Stanford, whatever that is. The Livermore Labs or whatever. I don't know what they're doing out there. But anyway, she sat in on some of the groups. It was very fascinating, and that's exactly what goes on.
Well, in about 3 months, we're going to have Dr. Edgar Mitchell on.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Edgar walked, was a sixth man to walk on the moon.
Yep.
And he's the president emeritus of the Noetic Institute of Noetic Sciences right now. And we'll get into remote viewing and mind energy.
Just as a matter of interest, Dr. Bourne. Hello.
Hello. Yes. Hello.
Hi. Are you related in any way to James Bourne?
Because
you ponder a lot, and you don't obfuscate, and you don't mumble. And Michael Jackson has had a James Bourne on, who's professional bureaucrat, has nothing to do with what we're talking about now, but the name just struck a chord.
No, I don't know the gentleman.
Good, good, because you are precisely the opposite of that.
I hope so.
Yes, you are.
I should hope so, yes.
Okay. Well, I've really enjoyed talking to you, Bill, and I'm going to listen to you more when I'm not lucky. And
thanks a lot.
Listen, I do listen to you a great deal. I just haven't called, that's all. And I'm glad you're there, and I sure hope to heck.
Well, on Saturday night, Chuck, just take an open mind break, okay?
That's right.
That's what I have. That's what I have. And I enjoy your guest tremendously. He's a very bright man. I'm not a physicist, but I hear what he's saying, and I get the essence of what he's doing there. I believe it.
Well, I appreciate you and where your mind's working, and may we help you
I'll call you again.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much. Oh, we have a bunch of them out there, don't we? All right. We have Benny on the line, I think it is. Benny?
Am I on?
You're on.
Oh. Right. Well, I don't know anything about science. I never studied it. So I've had to pick up everything by intuitive observation of all I've seen and known and experienced.
That's a good start.
That's a good, excellent way.
And, you know, so many things I know, but I don't know how to tell it. I don't know the scientific way. And
what's your question for Dr. Bourne?
Well, I just wonder how anyone my age, around 75, can, of course I could follow without having to be enrolled in school to learn science as one that hasn't had anything but just physics in high school, you know. I wonder if there's any books or anything that I could pick it up and learn a lot more scientific things about.
Maybe I can answer the question for you.
Go ahead, you try that.
I'm preparing a list. I promised to do this for a year, but I am seriously preparing
a list of
books that have been very, very important in the structuring of the Open Mind Show over the last 4 years.
That's a good idea.
And it is... I'm making it as easy as possible. Some of the papers that we certainly use in putting together the show are unavailable to a lot of people. But there are a lot of things that are available. And within the next couple of weeks, particularly if you're a KABC Talk radio card holder, you're going to have a chance to get that list and access to the books, okay?
That'll be great for her.
Yeah, I'd love to.
So I want you to stay with me, and I'll fill you in on those details as they come along.
Oh, sure.
Just be a little patient.
I would also, you know, like to find out if there's anything published now about the fact that we're held down by the atmosphere space. Because it occurred to me many times, but I never said anything to a few people, and they just smiled at me like, you know, they thought I was dreaming or something. I said, wouldn't it be interesting if we're held down by space instead of gravity pulling us from below?
Are there any books?
Is that right? Did you arrive at that little intuitive idea, too?
Yes, it just came to me one day. I've forgotten why. Something about gravity, and well, I always think of alternatives, you know.
You should have written a little article about that.
Well, it's very interesting to me. I just am thrilled when things come.
Is there anything
to
that she could read, Larry, that helped you in arriving at, you know, in your conclusions? I don't think that.
No.
Since I know of this, well, certainly is something that runs around in the underground.
Nothing, you know, I didn't arrive at this through reading about it from anyone else. It was just in studying Einstein's notions and Newton's notions and deciding that there was a way of blending them together.
All right. I tell you what, we'll try to get that list together for you to help you as much as possible.
It's just so wonderful to hear you talking about it on the radio. I'm just excited because I haven't heard anybody say anything like that.
Well, I'm excited to know that a lady can pick this up intuitively when I had to struggle for months and months and maybe years to arrive at it.
It makes you feel a little bit behind the times, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Well, I study a lot, but just observation and experience, you know, everything around me and people and anything I can pick up. So
absolutely.
It isn't all together just me. It's from all that I've gathered all my life.
Well, we see that happening more and more these days.
Right.
With a lot of people like yourself, and perhaps we can be helpful to you. And I thank you very much for your call.
thank you very much.
You know, I had a chance to mention just a second the KABC Talk Radio card, and I do want to encourage all of you to get down to your Alpha Beta store right at the checkout stand. There's an application for it. And you get your card. That's going to give you access to a lot of two-for-one bargains, trips to Hawaii, $7,900 cash prizes, all kinds of things we'll be doing to KABC listeners that hold their card. And we have some special things for Open Mind listeners on tap if you are a card holder. That list probably will be one of it, but there are some other things, too. So get to your Alpha Beta store and get your application as soon as possible. I built some of these things that you're talking about, and certainly there's a wealth of information beyond that. What do you have on your mind?
Oh, yes.
How do we reach you?
Okay, I'm in the L.A. area. I'll give out my private phone number. But guess what it is. It's 483-7351. Okay, from 8 a.m. in the morning to 12 noon.
It's no longer private.
It's no longer private, so I'm welcoming anyone to discuss any of these things or ask any questions and confer on, for example, the movie project that we're working on, for example, and the Upside Down World Awareness Movement that we'd like to start and launch a lot of things along these lines because it's a very big issue with very big possibilities, gigantic possibilities.
Uh-huh.
And the name of the movie project, by the way, is the Upside Down Conspiracy. Doesn't that sound intriguing?
I've heard and seen bits and pieces of that very fascinating thing that you're working on, really.
Oh, yes, you did. We showed you the treatment on it, yes.
Sure did.
And we revised it even and strengthened it greatly since then, by the way.
All right.
It's a tremendous story with Rob Rudelson, right?
Yeah, do you have a mailing address somebody wants to write you? Or they could send it to me here and I'll forward it on to you if you're ready.
No, 1514 and a quarter. Glendale Boulevard. L.A. 90026.
Telephone number again?
Is 483-7351.
Okay, you ready to talk to June?
Ready to talk to June.
June
sounds like the lady.
Hello, June.
I have been waiting a long time to talk to you, Dr. Boron.
I'm sorry. Well,
thank you.
No, because I really appreciate Tom Jenkins here.
Bill Jenkins.
There I blurped it, huh?
What am I going to do with you, June?
You know why? Because you got me off track with that barber lady. That's what it was.
Oh, that was it.
Hey,
yes.
That's one of my loves, you know, so I have to make time for her.
Is she the one that sings that song in the morning?
Mm-mm.
Oh, good.
No, that's another one of his loves. He's had many, many loves.
Okay. Well, you're talking about gravity. I didn't hear the show right from the beginning, but I've been on the line for quite a while now. And the thing about this gravity deal, I went to a doctor in Pasadena about 8 years ago because I couldn't walk. I had a sciatic condition, you know, sciatic nerve.
Uh-huh.
And you sound so enthusiastic with your uh-huh there. And his name is Robert Martin, and he believes in this gravity. He invented the gravity girder, and he believes in the gravity system to correct back ailments.
Is that the thing you turn upside down in?
Yeah.
There's one or two or three different ways of doing that, including gravity boots, even.
He has that also.
Oh.
Uh-huh.
I turned upside down on one of those things over at Helga Kohler's place.
What did it do for you, Bill?
I loved it. It was a delightful position to be in, except it hurt my ankles after a while.
All the blood rushes to your head, and it makes you think better probably
sure
after that.
Uh-huh. See, and he doesn't believe in surgery. He used to do surgery.
Oh.
And,
he's a doctor, you mean?
The doctor, right.
Oh.
Dr. Robert Martin is his name, and I appreciate him, Bill, like I appreciate you, really. I really mean that. I thank God for him, really.
Thank you very much.
And the thing also, too, is Another thing, I saw a woman on a television show who sang upside down.
Oh, come on now. That's...
I swear it's a bit.
Great.
I saw her sing upside down. So I mentioned this to the doctor, and he said he had a patient who sang upside down. And I'm serious.
I'll put them in my movie. Wonderful.
Really?
Well, listen, when you're hanging upside down, what else is there to do? You know, you might as well.
No. But actually, you know, I'm a singer also. So I tried doing that, and I can do it.
Can you really?
I can sing upside down.
We're
Jill,
planning.
Can you sing better upside down?
Well, you know, amazingly, it sounds the same either way.
It sounded better to you anyway, probably. Huh?
It's a lot freer.
Of course. We're thinking of creating a musical group called the Upside Downers or something like that, and they're going to sing occasionally a little bit upside down.
Are Larry? You really serious?
Larry,
no, I am serious.
Larry, is there any value trying to, you know, what June is talking about there in turning your body upside down, topsy-turvy? Is this, in your way of thinking, is there some therapeutic value to this, to the human system?
Yes, the doctors claim that have worked with that type of thing, like the gravity boots and the machine that puts you upside down, and also the slant board, even, that puts you halfway, you know, diagonally upside down. They say that when the blood flows from the feet towards the head, you're reversing the natural course of the effect of gravity, which is always pulling down your muscles towards your feet, you might say, including the sagging, wrinkly lines of your face, so that they actually claim that it reverses this aging process to a certain extent,
right, exactly.
by the flow of the blood going the other way and the wrinkles and everything, sagging tissues going the other way.
In your way of thinking, based upon your research and your understanding of things, is that valid?
Yeah, I would say that makes a lot of sense, absolutely.
Could I ask another question?
Of
Make
course.
It quick, because we've got...
Since you've been talking to all these people, so many questions popped in my mind. Do you remember a woman named Catherine Coleman? She passed
absolutely.
On. All right, now when she touched people and they fell back, was that some energy in her hands or was a placebo effect in the other person's mind?
Maybe a combination of both.
It could have been a combination. I think she had a strong energy of some sort, of spiritual nature coming through her hands. I wouldn't be surprised at all that it could...
What is the discipline that's particularly prevalent in China? Tai Chi? Tai Chi, where the energy does come out from the fingers. In fact, I think it was Brezhnev that had bodyguards that had an ability of this, and they could actually knock a man down, and then sometimes just by using their arms and fingers could crack the skull. And they didn't have to use any kind of instrumentality.
And they didn't even touch the person.
Didn't touch them.
Okay, another thing, gentlemen, you all saw the color red through the blue light there. You saw red.
Mm-hmm.
That's because you were all males looking at the blue light.
Now, we have a female here looking at it also.
Oh, is that right?
That's true.
Because they say males see colors different than females.
Well, yeah, you saw it. So you got the same effect, so that blows that theory, Joe.
Okay.
Every human eye that's ever looked, man, woman, or child, sees the same color, red, exactly.
Okay, Joe.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your comments on that. And now we're in for it. Craig is on the line.
Oh.
And Craig is always extremely challenging.
What's his last name?
Well, I
have two Craigs that call him. Both of them always do it to us.
Because I know of another Craig.
This is the Van Nuys Craig.
Right.
Hello, Craig. What's on your mind?
Hi. Well, first I'll just say really quickly, I believe this Tuesday, the NOVA program on KCET is going to deal with the military research into ESP.
Yes, it is.
It should be interesting. See what they come up with.
By the way, Russell Targ will be on the show with me in April as soon as his book called The Mind Race is out. He was going to be on in February, but we're going to time that with his book, and this will be his first major appearance.
Targ and Putoff, they've done a lot together.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I see we've only got about 3 minutes here. I'm going to have to make this pretty rushed. You can take for granted that I'm always challenging conventional wisdom, so, you know, I appreciate people who take a fresh look at this. I'm really having a bit of trouble accepting what you're replacing the conventional wisdom with tonight. The gravity thing. You know, Einstein, the way he explained it is that the material bodies distort space-time continuum.
Right, absolutely.
And as a result of that, we see the effect that we call gravity.
We see a curved space first.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we don't literally see
it's supposed to happen anyway.
Now, what are you replacing that with? You're talking about some sort of all-pervading ether.
I don't even have to resort to the ether. I merely included that. But I'm saying that even the space-time continuum, if you listen very, very closely now, If you can distort the space-time continuum by the presence of matter, especially large bodies of matter called celestial bodies, mm-hmm. anything that can be distorted by matter or deformed partakes of the laws of materiality and therefore is subject to what one of the older early scientists, I believe it was Robert Hooke and Hooke's law, says that the law of deformation is proportional to the law of, it was called the law of elasticity, that the force, what do they call it, the replacing force? There's another word for it, but it means the force that's equal and opposite to the stretching force or deforming force. There has to be a balance between these, when especially applies to elastic bodies such as a rubber sheet, which was often used in the Einstein analogies, that if you depress a rubber sheet with a solid ball in the center of it, what I'm saying is that the rubber sheet pushes up with an equal force against the deforming body. And this is according to the accepted laws, but they haven't applied it to the space-time continuum. Even though they allow it to be deformed, they haven't applied the opposite law, which says that if it's whatever amount it's deformed in one direction, it has to be it has to respond backwards in the other direction through the law of elasticity.
Well, we don't know that the law of elasticity would apply in this particular case.
Yes,
we do. After all, it's an analogy.
No, wrong, completely wrong. Okay, there's one of the most famous scientists in the world today. His name Andreev Sakharov of Russia, of the Soviet Union. He came up about 15 or 18 years ago with a new discovery, and he put it out in a book or a paper, a long article, called The Discovery of the Elasticity of Space. See, and
Well, that's a semantic
problem. No, it wasn't semantic at all. It's based on the stored energy fields in space to give it the ability to respond elastically.
Okay, I can buy that.
Okay, if you can buy it, then buy it and go all the way. So you have to go all the way with something you buy.
Okay, but that didn't sound like what you were talking about before.
Well, I didn't go into that particular aspect, but that has been, nevertheless, that's related to what I'm talking about. I also mentioned that the ether theory comes into play for those who want to believe in an ether theory. But I'm saying you don't have to believe in the ether theory. You can deal with just the space-time continuum from the point of view of Sakharov and others who follow his reasoning.
Well, if you go by Occam's razor, we should use the simplest means elucidate what
always,
we're talking about.
Always the simplest means, exactly.
So why throw in an ether theory if it's not needed?
Well, I don't myself require it, but believe me, it answers an awful lot of questions when you go into it deeply, especially the approach of Dirac, which is the positron-electron ether.
I have to require something here. Craig,
oh, yes.
Thank you very much for your call. There's our walk-in music means that we have got to go.
I hear it.
Larry, thank you for coming along tonight. Jim Moore will be with me next week. We'll be talking about those wonderful UFOs. 2 hours full of that and some new things. We'll see you then. Stay tuned for Barbara Estenson.